I only wanted to get a sick cert, and instead of getting a sick cert, about 6 hours later, I was lying in a hospital bed with no appendix. So I ended up getting an emergency appendectomy just to get an extension on my thesis.
I can only quote John McEnroe. You cannot be serious. Usually in the Insights podcast series, there's an obvious reason for inviting people for interview. Fame and fortune in an area of public life, be it politics, sport or entertainment. In this episode, our versatile guest has experience of several careers and pursuits: barrister, rabbit breeder, encyclopedia seller, marathon runner, journalist, chief executive, wife and mother. Aileen Hickey, you're very, very welcome to the Insights podcast.
Thank you.
We'll come back a little later to the pet rabbits that you and your husband, Matt Cooper, fell into breeding. And we'll also talk about Parentline. That's the charity you lead. But I reckon, Aileen, that your formative years gave you the keys to surviving and succeeding at most things: a family business in an Irish market town and boarding school.
Absolutely. So I'm from Mill Street, which is in North Cork. I think most people, when I say Mill Street, associated with two things: the Eurovision, which was held there in 1993. And I think we have the honour of being the smallest town that the Eurovision was ever held in. And also the Green Glens Arena, which is very famous for horse jumping and show jumping and all the rest of it. So I grew up in Mill Street. My parents ran the Central Hardware Stores, which sounds a lot grander than what it actually was, but it was central in the town in that the shop is in the square. We had the petrol pumps for the town, sold plough parts and everything else. So, you know, I would have worked in the shop as a child, and, you know, I could have been handing out £2 of nails, you know, filling 3 gallons of petrol, selling a jigsaw, a communion handbook, paint, egg slicers, referring someone to get their ears pierced. My mother also did the picture framing in the town. Strawberries, because we had a market garden. So literally everything apart from bread and milk.
So, and the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah.
Or the Cork Examiner.
Yeah.
As it was then. And then boarding school close by, not very far from home.
A mile and a half, actually, from my own house. I could practically smell my mother frying the chips and sausages in the evening from my dormitory window. So literally, it's Drashan Convent. And as I say, it's literally, you know, a 15-minute walk from where we grew up. I suppose I was like a lot of the people in the area, and that people who had businesses or who had farms. And, you know, I suppose my mother was working as well. She was a nurse, and she was an ambulance nurse. So apart from working in the shop, she was working, you know, as a nurse and as an ambulance nurse. So they were busy. And I was the eldest of four, and we were sent to boarding schools. All the three girls were sent to boarding school. The boy, obviously, who was the only child, was kept at home because he was a boy. So he was allowed to stay at home. But the rest of us were sent to boarding school, and we came home every second weekend at 2 o'clock on a Saturday to 8 o'clock on a Sunday. The only time we would see our parents in the meantime was my parents were one of the only people at the time who had a car. Again, this sounds much fancier than what it is, but we had a car with a sunroof, and they would do a drive-through and throw bags of sweets out the window of the car for myself and my friends. And that would happen ever so often. But other
by
than
arrangement,
that,
I trust.
Not by arrangement, because there was no mobile phones or anything else. So, but they would know the times that we wouldn't be in class, and, you know, they would guess at it, and they'd just do a quick drive-through.
And did you like boarding school? I mean, was it a kind of a Mallory Towers experience with midnight feasts and all that kind of thing?
This was no Swiss finishing school, now I can tell you, Sean. So there was nothing like that. I mean, I actually loved it, I have to say. You know, I have great friends from boarding school. You know, two of my best friends are girls that I started off in my very first dormitory with. I have great connections from there. You know, it was a very small boarding school. There was only, you know, even maybe about 120 even at the outside between all 5 years that were in there at the time. Obviously, there was no TY year or anything like that, so it was just straightforward. 5 years, and there was maybe 28 to 30 maximum in any of the classes in any of the years. So I had a great time. I got to meet, you know, a lot of people from, you know, internationally and, you know, from all over Ireland, because there was very few from my local area there. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. I mean, we railed against the food and we railed against the rules. And, you know, I wasn't averse to having, you know, maybe a sneaky pull on somebody else's cigarette behind the castle walls, you know, and trying to break as many rules as I could. But, you know, I stayed within the boundaries.
And then once you had done your leaving cert, you decided to expand your horizons a bit and travel up to Dublin.
I did. So when the CAO forms came out, I had a look at it. Nearly everybody in my class was going to locally to university, or most of them actually were going to nursing. Some were going to teaching. Some were going to the civil service. They were kind of the jobs at the time. I mean, you know, this is kind of the mid 1980s and they were the areas that people were going into. And nothing against my parents and nothing against Mill Street, but I didn't want to stay locally, and I didn't want to be local enough that I would have to go home all the time. So I decided I wanted to go to Dublin. I'd also decided at that stage that I was going to be the next Thelma Mansfield, who I had fixated myself on. As I said, mentioned before, we had a picture framing business at home as well. And I would regularly take the empty frames and put my own picture on them and pretend I was Thelma Mansfield in the mirror. So I'd practiced being Thelma Mansfield for quite a long time.
You better explain to listeners, not everybody would remember Thelma Mansfield.
Thelma Mansfield was a very well-known RTE continuity announcer, you know, at that time. And then she went on to present Live at Three with Derek Davis, I think, from around the mid 1980s. And, you know, I was either going to be Farrah Fawcett from Charlie's Angels or Thelma Mansfield. And Thelma Mansfield seemed a bit more achievable than being Farrah Fawcett in Charlie's Angels.
Did you ever get to meet Thelma?
I did get to meet Thelma because she subsequently became an artist, and I met her at a couple of art exhibitions actually in the RGS. And I have mentioned this to her before. She was laughing. But anyway, to go along with my picture framing of myself, I needed something to actually back it up. So I had found a degree in communications in what was then NIHE, which is now DCU in Glasnevin. Now, I'd never heard of NIHE. I'd been in Dublin once on a day trip to the zoo with my parents. I didn't know anybody in Dublin. I had no relations in Dublin. I had no friends in Dublin. But I decided I was going to Dublin. So I announced to my mother, who thought I was going to UCC, I put down my first choice as being communications in IHE, and I got it, much to the shock and horror of my mother. And then we had to go through, you know, her having to bring me up that summer to find digs for me, because again, there was no posh apartment for me and I didn't know anybody in Dublin. So we had to go and find digs with this very nice kind of middle-aged couple out in, well, they were very nice at the beginning. They didn't really like me by the end, but out in Glasnevin. And I started the Dublin end of my life, which is where I've lived ever since.
How studious were you in college? I mean, did I hear somewhere that you went to extreme measures to get an extension on a thesis deadline?
You might have. So yeah, in my third year in college, I had spent most of my time socialising. I also had tried to be the entertainments officer on the Students' Union. I didn't actually make it, but I spent a lot of time campaigning for myself. And it was coming close to a thesis deadline. I realised there was no way I was going to make the thesis deadline. So I pretended that I had a very bad pain in my side, but I'm a very good actress. I don't know if I've mentioned this as part of my litany of attributes, but I'm a very good actress. And I was far too good at the acting. And I only wanted to get a sixth cert. And instead of getting a sixth cert, about 6 hours later, I was lying in a hospital bed with no appendix. So I ended up getting an emergency appendectomy just to get an extension on my thesis.
I can only quote John McEnroe. You cannot be serious. That actually happened.
That actually happened in my third year in college. There's a number of people who can attest to it. All those who were in college with me at the time, because they were sending in messages and they were visiting me, because everyone thought this was hysterical. And I suppose the funniest bit of it all is that I still didn't manage to get the thesis in time. I still didn't make the deadline even after all that. And what I will say is that I hope for my own kids that they finish college with both a degree and an intact appendix.
So you were in college then for presumably, what, 3 or 4 years? And what did you do then? I mean, you found yourself heading to the States, is that right?
Yeah, I was in college for 3 years and I had a great time in college, and I was settled in very well. Actually, there's numerous people from RTE who were in my class in college, you know, including your former Director General of RTE, Noel Kern. So, you know, I had a superb time in college, despite the fact that my sense of direction was so poor. I didn't actually find the college on the first day. It took me 2 days to find the college. But anyway, despite that, and once I left college, I had done the previous summer, I'd gone on a J1 to the States and really enjoyed it. So once I finished college, I decided to go back over to the States. Again, it was the mid 1980s in Ireland, and that was a time of recession and unemployment, you know, so there wasn't a whole pile over here anyway. So I went back to the States with a friend of mine. We had previously lived in Cape May, New Jersey. We went back there again, just hopping around, waitressing, cocktail waitressing, you know, chambermaiding and all the rest of it, and stayed there for another 4 or 5 months. Then I moved to Florida, to Fort Lauderdale in Florida, again doing more of the same vein. I suppose I was there about a total of about a year and a half. And, you know, despite the fact that there was no mobile phones, my mother still managed to impinge on me enough to get me home in the end, because I think she'd had enough of me wandering around and taking a very scenic route to doing nothing.
Did she know about the stalker? Tell us about him.
That was in Florida. That was in Fort Lauderdale. She didn't know about it at the time. She does know about it since, obviously. But we were living in Fort Lauderdale. We were living in a very classy place called the Hurricane Motel. You can imagine how classy that was. And I was working in a hotel, and one of the people in the kitchen took a particular shine to me. And he would regularly ask me out, and I would regularly say no. And he would ask me to go to concerts, and I'd say no. He'd buy tickets for the concerts. I'd still say no. And then he'd taken at that stage to driving up and kind of parking outside our room in the motel, so I could see his car from kind of the bedroom window. And then one evening he just rocked up, and, you know, we opened the door and he was there and he had a gun, and he said, "You're coming to the concert, you know, that's the end of it." Now, I was very lucky in that the person that I was sharing the room in the motel was with me, and also there was a number of people outside, you know, just, I don't know what they were doing, they might have been having a smoke or something, and they got him and they got the gun off him. You know, I suppose, I mean, I don't know if he would have actually done anything. He was certainly threatening. We didn't report it because my friend who was with me was illegal in the States at the time, and we didn't want to get him into trouble. But it was, you know, it was pretty scary, but it makes for a very good story in latter years.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been very, very scary, as you say, at the time. I mean, did you take a little time to get over it?
I probably didn't, to be honest. I mean, I think, you know, when you're young like that, you know, things kind of wash off you. I mean, I think it was probably, again, in later years when I was remembering the details, or, you know, when I was talking to my friend who I'd been with, and he would say, "Do you remember what happened?" And, were you, you know, because he witnessed it all. And I think in retrospect, I found it more scary than I did at the time.
I suppose also having children of your own who are old enough and probably have been off on the J1 programme, it might give you something to remind them of.
It certainly does give me a lot to remind them of. There's a lot of stuff, though, about college and the J1 programme that I wouldn't like them to follow my direct lead on.
Or even know about.
Or even know about, absolutely. Yeah.
So pretty soon after coming back to Ireland from the States, from your travels there, you ended up in Galway.
I came back to Dublin, and again, so this would have been maybe 1989, kind of 1988-89. Again, very little employment, very little jobs going around, particularly because while I loved my degree in communications, it actually didn't leave me qualified for very much. You know, I mean, you know, I had gone for it for the attraction of television and radio production, but there was economics and statistics and everything else in it. And I really wasn't. It was a very broad degree, and I wasn't qualified for anything, as my mother had warned me that I wouldn't be. But anyway, I came home from America and realised I really wasn't qualified for anything. And I started looking in the paper. I needed a job. I was sleeping on somebody's floor, and I saw an ad for a salesperson. I didn't examine the ad carefully enough. Again, this wouldn't be the best guidance to any young people today to follow my path. But anyway, I applied for this particular job. It was with a company called Grolier. And before I knew it, I'd been offered the job, and the job was selling encyclopedias door to door. And I can tell you now, Sean, if you can sell encyclopedias door to door, you can do anything for the rest of your life. I mean, they say if you work behind a bar, it's a great footstep onto any career path after that, because you'll be able to do any job. But selling encyclopedias takes it one step further. And not only that, but they were moving me straight away to the regionalised area, which was Galway. And I had never lived in Galway before. I'd been to Galway only for Rag Week before that. So suddenly I was in Galway. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anything about Galway. I had to find some place to live. And I found some place to live off Air Square. And then I would be driven by the kind of the sales manager every day into an area in the wider environs of Galway, County Galway, and left there at 10 o'clock in the morning with a briefcase full of sample encyclopedias and an order book. And they'd be back to collect me at 6 o'clock. And I would have to basically kind of talk my way into people's houses to try and sell them these sets of encyclopedias.
And how good at it were you then? I mean, it seems that you did all right at it.
Well, I did enough to survive and pay rent in Galway. So, you know, it was commission-based only. I mean, you know, I still remember it was 600 punts for the set of encyclopedias. There was the New Book of Knowledge, and there was the Academic Encyclopedia. It was 600 punts, and I would get 60 punts commission for each set that I sold. So, you know, my target was to kind of sell 3 to 4 sets a week in order to be able to pay the rent and survive. Some weeks I did better, some weeks I did worse, But I managed to pay my rent and feed myself. You know, it might have been cans of baked beans and bottles of Stag, but I managed to live.
How long did you stick at it for?
I stuck at it for just over a year. And at that stage, they were moving me back to Dublin. I decided if I was coming back to Dublin, I was also going to be looking for a better job when I came back to Dublin. So I came back to Dublin, and having decided that I was now an expert at sales, I still had no fully blown career path. I thought of journalism around that stage, but I hadn't, you know, I made a full decision on it, and I hadn't figured out the way to get into it. So the Dublin Tribune was just starting up. It was an affiliate of the Sunday Tribune. This is 1990 I'm talking now, and I saw that the Dublin Tribune were looking for telesales executives. So I applied for the job and got the job, and went into telesales in the Dublin Tribune. My area was called House and Home. So basically I was dealing with the builders, the tilers, bathroom fitters, carpenters and all the rest of it. And I was phenomenally good at selling the ads, and I was phenomenally bad at getting any of the ads paid for. So I was being hauled over the coals on a regular basis by the management and the Dublin Tribune for bad debts, essentially, for failing to get my ads paid for, you know. So it was great.
No wonder it didn't last very long.
Yeah, because the Dublin Tribune, again, I had a great time. You know, at the time, the Dublin Tribune was being edited by Mick Hand.
The famous Mixer.
Yeah, Mixer was then there, and Rory Godson was his deputy. And there was a great crew of journalists in there who've gone on to do very stellar journalistic work. And, you know, I really enjoyed my time. Again, I really enjoyed my time in there. I have great friends still from that time. But I went on my first kind of foreign holiday, aside from the States, in the early summer of 1992. I went to Tenerife with a friend of mine. And while we were there, she worked in the Dublin Tribune as well. And we were maybe 3 days into our holidays when we got phone calls to say that we'd been made redundant. The Dublin Tribune was closing. So we finished and enjoyed the rest of our holidays, came back. I suppose the good thing for me was that I got a redundancy check, and I decided that I would save half of it for whatever I was going to do next, which I was hoping was going to be journalism. And then I spent the other half in a car. And in the meantime, I applied for a job in sales in the Sunday Business Post. And my sales pitch at that stage was so good that I managed to double my wages going into the Sunday Business Post, because I managed to convince them what a good salesperson I actually was. I didn't mention the bad debts end of it. And I was now selling ads in the Sunday Business Post. I started there in the summer of 1992.
And by the sound of it, from what I've been hearing and reading about you, you didn't just go in there to sell ads, did you?
Are you assuming I went in there to look for a man? Because that's what it sounds like.
That thought obviously crossed your mind.
Well, that thought would have crossed my mind I wasn't looking for a man. I suppose I was always kind of had my eye out. But I started in there on a Monday morning, and I did say to one of the more established people, I said, you know, is there anybody here that, you know, I'd be casting an eye over? And she said, there's only one fella that I think you'd be interested in. She said, but he's away this week on a work trip. I think he was in the States. And she said, his name is Matt Cooper. And I said, all right. I said, well, you know, anyway, so I put my work in for the week. And then the following Monday, this, you know, tall lad with long blonde hair passed me by. And I was informed that that was the Matt Cooper that they'd been telling me about. And there was a going away due for someone that the following Thursday evening. And I managed to entrench myself enough that I had a date offer by the end of the night from Matt, and we...
You probably didn't feel you had much choice at that stage. Given what you've said before about spending time beside the photocopier, which was adjacent to his workspace. Yeah.
It was, yeah. The photocopier was literally right next to his workstation. So I spent the 4 days between the Monday and Thursday of that week photocopying everything I could find up and down with freshly brushed hair and lipstick every time I went down there. So, I mean, I think he would have felt like I was there for 4 years rather than 4 days, considering the amount of time I spent down at the photocopier. So he knew me well by the Thursday night. And we started going out that following Sunday night, and that was August 1992, and we got engaged the following year, August 1993. and married 2 years after that, August 95.
Very interesting. And in the meanwhile, you decided to look for a different job, which was, well, transitioning from selling ads to actually putting in the editorial matter between them.
So in conversations with Matt, I expressed that I had wanted to do journalism for, you know, quite a bit of time. And I suppose, you know, right from the days of communications, and I suppose even before communications, you know, I mean, I wasn't just talking about Thelma Mansfield. That was the kind of career trajectory I'd hoped for. I just hadn't done a whole pile about it. He said, you know, kind of, you know, if you're going to do it, stop talking about it and just do it. So I applied for the Masters in Journalism in what was now DCU, which had been my previous alma mater in IHE. And I got into the Masters in Journalism that year, 1993, did a 1 year full time Masters in Journalism. Again, had a fantastic year, you know, met a great crew of journalists that I still know today. And then I was placed on my work placement in the Sunday Business Post. So I was now back in the Sunday Business Post, but as a working journalist. So I was delighted with myself.
Yeah, I mean, did the fact that he was from Cork have anything to do with how well you got on?
Well, I suppose water meets its own level, if you want to look at it like that. So it might have. So, now, he would say, though, that he is a townie, you know, he's Cork City, and that I'm very much a mucker for Bill Street. You know, so he would make a big segregation between the townies and the Colchis. But, you know.
So you spread your wings, so to speak, in journalism, Aileen. I mean, you, I think, worked across different media. You were in the Sunday World for quite a while, were you?
I was in the Sunday World for about 10 years. I had a money page, a financial page. It was called Sunday Money with Aileen Hickey, and I had my own picture byline. And again, I was delighted with that. I did a bit of property journalism for the Tribune. I did features for the Irish Independent, particularly for the weekend edition. And I did a column called Influences in the Sunday Business Post.
Now, did you get bored with journalism, or what drew you then to decide you were going to go and study law?
Well, again, I suppose it had been another area that I'd kind of long fingered and had thought about. But again, I'd gone into journalism at this stage. I suppose the main reason I went into law, to be really honest, is that myself and Matt were now married and we were both journalists. His career path was certainly on a much higher trajectory than mine. I mean, I had a very nice amount of work and I was very happy with the journalism work that I had. And I had, you know, I had my finger in numerous freelance pies, for want of a better word. But, you know, he became the editor of the Sunday Tribune. And I suppose I didn't want the appearance that I was getting work because of who he was. And, you know, I just decided that it was better if I wasn't doing the same work as he was, considering where his career path was going. So we talked about it. And I decided that I would apply to do the bar at King's Inns, not having a law degree previously. So I would have to do the 4 years in King's Inns by night, which I did between 1996 and 2000. I continued working in journalism for those 4 years, freelance journalism during the day. And then I'd go down in the evenings to King's Inns. And again, you know, it was fantastic. I met a fantastic crew of people. I was thrilled to be doing it because, again, it was like something that I'd wanted really badly, and suddenly I was there.
And did you practice?
So I was called in 2000. At that stage, I had a 1 year old little girl and I was pregnant with my second child. I devilled in between 2000 and 2001 with the very well known High Court Judge Tony Hunt. And that was a fantastic learning curve for me because Tony Hunt is a superb judge. He was a superb barrister in the criminal area. But what I did decide during that year was the criminal law wasn't actually for me. I had small children and, you know, I suppose I felt that particularly at that time for women barristers, they seemed to be given more sexual assault cases and, you know, more in that kind of area. And I read in enough books of evidence that left me, you know, having sleepless nights. And I decided that wasn't the area that I wanted to go into. So then I devilled for a second year in civil law, which I really enjoyed. I did a bit of succession law. I did, I did PI. I kind of put my finger in every pie. My difficulty was that in those years, I was continuing to have children. So I would no sooner build up a bit of practice than I would have to go off to have another child. So,
I was wondering just how did you fare out when it came to maternity leave, or did you?
I didn't. So, on the first one, I think I took 2 weeks and I was back in. In retrospect, I would never do it again. It was an absolute mistake, and there's no huge gain to be done from it. I wouldn't, you know, any of my own girls, I certainly wouldn't make a suggestion of anything near what I did. I didn't give myself enough time to recover, and I suppose I didn't give myself enough time to do proper bonding with them or anything else. So I as I had more of them, the maternity leaves, you know, I did make them longer and longer. But, you know, given that my maternity leave was unpaid, obviously, because I, you know, as a barrister, I was self-employed. So, you know, and also, it wasn't just the fact that I was self-employed and it was unpaid, but I would have handed over the work that I was doing to somebody else for when I wasn't working. So there was, you know, you're always cognizant of is getting the work back and making sure that they would give you the work back and how far had a case progressed and you would want the work back. And, you know, I finally made the decision in 2007. At that stage, I just had my fifth child. I had five children under the age of seven. And, you know, I it was literally, you know, I like banging my head against a brick wall to try and make a dent in being a barrister while continually having babies and going back and trying to rebuild a bit of practice. And, you know, so in 2007, again, after a lot of long conversations and a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of hair pulling, because, you know, I'd spent 4 years by night doing this and I'd really wanted it. And I, you know, I had done my deviling and I put my back into it. But I decided at that stage that I couldn't keep all the balls in the air. You know, I'm not someone that believes that you can always keep all the balls in the air.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. That is there a sense that, and I've had this conversation previously, say, with Adele Coffey, the author and journalist, and in fact, a lot of her activity previously would kind of be similar to your own, doing freelance work and that kind of thing, and working for magazines, that is there an unfair expectation on women to kind of be seen to do it all, to be superwoman?
Absolutely. So, you know, and that would be seen to where it'd be seen where the bar is, that that's what you have to achieve to, you know, that you have to, again, you know, look good, get your figure back, get your career fully back, have all these lovely, perfectly dressed children and have it all. And, you know, I found that I didn't have, not only did I not have it all, but I was finding that I didn't really have anything, because I literally, you know, I wasn't being a good enough mother at home, because, I didn't have time to concentrate on what I was doing at home. I didn't know my kids' friends. I didn't know what was in their lunchboxes. And yet, I couldn't fully concentrate when I was at the bar, because if one of them was sick at home, I was constantly worried, you know, had they been given Calpol, what was happening at, you know, had they been brought to their activities, you know, so I was constantly worried about the various levels of childcare that were going on. So definitely it was too much for me. I mean, I knew I couldn't keep all the balls in the air. And as I say, it was a very difficult decision to do it. And I will also say, Sean, it was a very difficult decision on the back end of it as well, because when I did suddenly stopped being a barrister and became a stay-at-home mother, it was an extremely difficult transition, because, you know, I'm not the most domesticated at the best of times. And suddenly I had to transition into, you know, doing all the stuff that I hadn't been doing and, you know, being with these small kids all the time, and which, that's why I had them. So, I mean, I there's no poor me involved in this. I mean, you know, that's what I became a mother for, and that's why I had them. But it was still a big transition, because, you know, I was suddenly a bit more isolated and I didn't have the social element and I didn't have the work element and I didn't have, I suppose, the intellectual stimulation that I would have had in previous careers and at the bar.
Were you getting any advice from Mill Street as to how to handle all of these dilemmas?
Well, I think the only advice I ever had from Mill Street is when I rang my mother to tell her I was pregnant with my fifth, there was absolute silence, and she said, "I thought you'd know better." She, by the way, had four herself, so she'd obviously decided that the fifth was the tipping point.
That was some comfort right enough.
Yeah, that was the answer she gave. There was no congratulations or anything of the sort. And, you know, again, I suppose, you know, my mother wasn't one of these hand-holdy mothers, you know, constantly, you know, "Are you okay?" and helicoptering over you. I mean, you know, there was times I said that I didn't know, half the time I don't think she knew what I was doing, where I was living, what I was up to. And there was great comfort in that. And that's why she's now 90. I'd probably live to 70 with her at the rate I'm going, because I'm so worried about them all the time. But she's lived to 90 because she didn't have all those worries, and she didn't constantly indulge herself in wondering how all her children were and what they were doing.
Meanwhile, Matt, your husband and your father had bonded in over a business conversation way back in the Eurovision time.
Yes, they certainly had. So that was back in 1993. So we had a yard out the front, and when the Eurovision was coming to Mill Street, one of the biggest concerns was that there was only one ATM in the town, and they didn't know if one ATM would be enough, considering, you know, the hordes of people that were going to be coming to Mill Street. So my father was approached by a bank, and he was asked, could they put a mobile ATM a.m. in the yard. So he rang Matt, and he wasn't for it at all in the first place, because my father was very protective of his yard. You weren't allowed parking there. He had chains up on the outside to make sure that there was, you know, at market day, there was nobody allowed parking the yard, you know, because it does look like a big car park nearly in the front of it. So, but my father would stop all that. So he certainly wasn't jumping up and down about having the ATM in the yard, because it would mean people crossing onto his turf. But he rang Matt and he told Matt about this offer and what the offer was. And Matt said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I don't think it's enough in the first place. So Matt said, look, go back and say that if they offer you three times what they've already offered you, you'll take it. My father did that. He was offered three times what the initial offer had been. He took it delightedly. I was very happy with Matt at the time. Put the ATM in the yard, and then the Eurovision people were in and out of the ATM. The Eurovision started, and we went to the Eurovision. We didn't actually go to the Eurovision. We went to the rehearsal night, which was, you know, just the night, the pre-Eurovision. And after it, we went to the pub and we had, you know, enjoyed ourselves, had a good few drinks and all the rest of it. And the following day, Matt was suffering, if you want to put it in a better way. And our house is very cold with no central heating. So we were all out having a walk or something. Matt had decided to stay at home in our house and he was feeling a bit chilly. So he decided he'd plug in the heater. So he went over to the wall and he took a plug out and he plugged in the heater. And the next thing, my father came tearing into the house and say, who's after unplugging my money machine? The money machine is down. So Matt had indulged himself to the point with the heat that he'd unplugged the ATM for the whole of Mill Street just to put on the heater.
Your dad is no longer with you, but your mother is, and she's still working away. Is that right?
Yeah, my father actually died 8 years ago, but my mother turned 90 in January. She's a fantastic woman. As I say, she had been a nurse and an ambulance nurse and worked the shop as well. And since the whole shop is closed, she's kept it going as a market shop during the summer. So she sells plants for the 3 months during the summer, every single summer, including last summer when she was 89. And she's fully planning on selling the plants again this summer. She says not only does it keep her active, but it keeps her engaged. It keeps her social, because there's people coming in and talking to her, and she's out watering the plants and she loves it.
Sounds like an absolutely mighty woman who'll be around for a while yet. But in any event, just a couple of things that I've been reading about you, Aileen, that and you wrote a very funny piece about getting the Easter bunnies. I mean, literally, tell us about that.
Yes. So this was about 12 or 13 years ago. An altruistic friend of ours gave us two male bunnies for Easter, for the kids for Easter. The kids, I think, were maybe around 1 to 8 or something like that at the time. So instead of having just the chocolate bunnies, we were given these two male bunnies for Easter. Now, I did question it. I questioned the maintenance of them and the cleaning and all the rest of it. She told me that there was no management to them and it would be all perfect. So we got the bunnies, and a couple of weeks after we got the bunnies and we had a hutch and everything, she, again, her kindness knew no limits. She gave me the hutch and all, and went out to the hutch. And male bunnies are known as bucks. So my two bucks had 9 little kits, which are what baby rabbits are called, and there didn't seem to be any surrogate or anything involved. They seem to have had the 9 baby bucks by themselves.
In the normal
remarkably,
way, in the normal way, as the politicians would say.
Despite both being bucks. Anyway, you know, I couldn't really blame my friend, so, because apparently it's very difficult to sex rabbits and you have to do various manoeuvrings to find out what they have going on or not. But anyway, we now had 9 little baby, 9 rabbits. And I, by the way, was no better at the sexting of them than she had been. So those 9 procreated numerous times after that. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we ended up, I would say I probably put about 80 rabbits through my hands in total. We ended up having 5 hutches in the back garden. We called one hutch, we called them all after the Jackson family. So there was Jermaine, Latoya, Jackie, Janet, Marlon, Randy, and not just by name, I can tell you. And it was fantastic for a while. And actually, one of the funny things was, I mean, I suppose I never had to tell my kids about the birds and the bees, because they saw it all going on in the back garden all day long with the rabbits. I mean, you know, when they were smaller, they'd be wondering what the rabbits were doing. And we'd say, oh, they're just having fun playing wheelbarrow races. they were having a lot more fun than that. But we did actually have great fun with the rabbits. Once or twice a week, I'd have to go into the garden to the five hutches. I literally put a refuse sack around myself. I step into the refuse sack, so the refuse sack would cover me from, you know, shoulders to ankles, to clean out the five rabbit hutches of, you know, stinking straw and sawdust and hay, you know, and replace the whole thing. Right. I was actually giving rabbits. I was doing bartering at that stage. I was giving rabbits to the pet shop in exchange for rabbit food. So like we'd become bunny farmers, you know, inadvertently. I mean, it certainly wasn't something we'd get out seeking, but, you know, suddenly, you know, we were absolute bunny farmers.
How long did all of that go on for?
I wish I could have said 2 weeks, but it was around 2 years. Like, it literally, you know, it went on and on and on. I mean, you know, there is even a story that there's a well-known television and radio presenter who had a sleepover in my house after a late night one night, and she was sleeping downstairs on the couch in the sitting room, which looks into the garden, and she woke up, and as she said, it was like Watership Down out there. I mean, she thought she had woken up in some sort of hallucinogenic nightmare, you know, seeing white rabbits all over the back garden.
I hope you're not talking about anybody of this parish, as they say.
No, it's not actually of this parish, Sean. That's the only thing, that's the only bit of information I'll give you.
Okay, wild horses or wild rabbits wouldn't drag the actual identity out. Okay, well, people will just have to guess, figure out for themselves who your friends are or where, maybe. So, marathon running then, as if or as though you didn't have enough to be doing. When did that start?
So in around 2012, I'd started doing the panel on the Midday Show, which at the time was being presented by Colette Fitzpatrick. And the show had started up in about 2008, 2009. And I was one of, maybe I started around 2009. It was a programme loosely based on Loose Women, with an anchor and a female-based panel. And I was one of the panellists. And the panellists were doing the Pink Run for a cancer charity, and they asked me would I do the 10K women's mini marathon. And now, at the time, I can tell you, I wouldn't run a bath, not to mind anything else. So, I mean, the idea of doing a 10K was like, I really didn't think I could do it. But, you know, they asked, and I wanted to be part of the team, and I wanted to do something for charity, so I said I'd do it. So I dug out a pair of runners, and I, like, all joking aside, like, they were leather topped runners that I think I'd had since Drashan, because I'd never replaced the pair of runners because I hadn't done any running. So I dug out the pair of runners, and I actually was running in a skirt because I didn't even have shorts. So I started the running, and anyway, I upgraded my running gear, and I did manage to do the 10K ladies marathon that year in 2012. And then later that year, somebody dropped out of doing the New York Marathon, which they were supposed to be doing for Temple Street. And Temple Street needed the funding and the sponsorship. And they asked me, would I do it? And again, I was reluctant to do it because I didn't think I'd be able to do it. But I agreed to do it because it was for Temple Street. So I went to New York in November 2012 to run the New York Marathon for Temple Street. And that, I can tell you, was my favourite marathon ever, because when I got to New York, Hurricane Sandy had happened and the marathon was cancelled. So I had 5 nights in New York with no marathon to run. It was an absolute... So we had a holiday.
Had you done much training for it?
I'd done a bucket of training. I'd been literally running the roads for the previous few months, like, non-stop. But I didn't mind, because, and actually, when we came back, the New York Marathon Association allowed the runners who went to New York to do it, and because it was cancelled, not anything to do with any of our fault, in Phoenix Park. So I ended up running the New York Marathon. The only time it's ever been run outside Ireland is in Phoenix Park, and I ended up running the New York Marathon in Phoenix Park. Now, that doesn't count for, you know, the World Marathon Series, because it's still seen as a different kind of a marathon, but I did run it. So I ran that in Phoenix Park that year. Following year, I ran Dublin Marathon. I ran the London Marathon. I had a gap for a couple of years because I think I just thought, okay, well, I've ran those marathons now. And then Temple Street came back to me in 2016 and asked me would I run another marathon for them, and I did. So I went on. So basically, to cut a long story short, I've completed the World Marathon Series of marathons. There are 6 World Marathon Majors. They are London, New York, which I went back and did again in 2016, London, New York, Chicago, Boston, Berlin, and Tokyo. And I finished off Tokyo in March last year, and I got my World Marathon medal for running the 6 World Majors. So
well done to you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is that it then, or are you still running? And, like, do you enjoy running?
I absolutely love running. So I'm still running. I've already signed up and paid for New York again this year, so I'm going to run in New York in November. The great thing about running the New York marathons is the ones I've ran have coincided with presidential elections, so you're there at a great time. You're there, you know, you're running the marathon, but you're actually there, you know, at a really exciting time, you know, because the election is going on. If they add more to the series, I will do more, and I have thought about doing the Arctic Marathon, which is run on, you know, obviously in a completely different way, but it is. I know I haven't actually said that to Matt yet, so you're the first to hear that. Okay, so.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he'd be there to carry your bag. I mean, it's the least he could do, you know.
Well, that's what he always does.
So, to talk now about your what you actually do for a living, as it were, at this stage, Parentline. What is that? You're the chief executive.
So I got the job in 2019. So I'm there just 4 and a bit years at this stage. Parentline is the most fantastic charity and the most fantastic organisation that I've ever come across. I got the job only because somebody mentioned to me they were looking for a chief executive. I didn't expect to get it. I didn't expect to love it as much as I do. It feels like it's everything that I've ever done come together in one particular job, because it's how I felt about parents and the difficulties they have and the supports, you know, that they need to give their children. It's my law background, my journalistic background, even my fundraising background, because I've done a lot of fundraising for other charities, even my encyclopedia knocking on people's doors background. It feels like they've all fused into the position that I have, you know, and that I can make it very workable like that. So Parentline is a national helpline. It gives information, support and guidance to parents on children of all ages and of all issues. So everything, we're the postnatal depression helpline as well. So everything from postnatal depression right through to parents who are dealing with adult children living in the family home, which is a significant issue. And about 17% of our calls would come from parents with concerns from children who are 18 to 25. Because, as you know, I mean, all my 5 still live at home. So, you know, children are living more and longer in the family home. I suppose the vast majority of our calls would still be in relation to teenagers, 13 to 17 years of age. About a third of our calls are in relation to a very difficult area, which is covered by the umbrella term child to parent violence. It's, you know, anger and aggression directed at a parent by a child. Now, it can be verbal abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, coercion, controlling behaviours. So there's a number of behaviours that cover it. But it's a very difficult area for parents to deal with when they're faced with that issue. And it's something that no parent thinks will ever come to their door.
What kind of qualifications, though, do the people who take those calls, the people at the other end of Parentline when the phone rings, how well qualified or trained are they?
Parentline has the most fantastic cohort of volunteers you're ever likely to come across. We have 60 volunteers, and we do, there's volunteers, new volunteers trained every year. But of the 60 volunteers, many of them are there, you know, 25, 30 years or more. I mean, there's volunteers.
It's going that long, is it?
The charity was 40 years in 2022. So it started out in 1982. It was started actually by social workers who were concerned that, you know, about parents trying to support their kids. So it's 42 years this year. So the 60 volunteers, the volunteers get a very intense training program, classroom based training, some Zoom based training, and then they have to come in and do listening skills. They have to be listened to while they make calls. They have to listen to other people making and take calls. We wouldn't let anybody answer the phones in Parentline unless they're giving the absolute top service that they can give to a parent who's calling, because not every parent who calls is in distress, but a lot of the parents who call can be in crisis or in distress, and they have to get the very top level of service that they can get from a volunteer. And again, what you have to remember is we're primarily a listening service. So, you know, often when a parent calls, they already know the answer, but they need validation that what they're doing is the right thing. And sometimes they just need to be told that, you know, it's okay not to be a perfect parent. It's okay just to be a good enough parent.
Indeed. And what would the breakdown be between male and female callers?
Well, now, when I started, I remember hearing a stat that, you know, at the time there was maybe 3 or 4% of callers were male. Prior to that, there had been talk that, you know, if you got a call from a male caller, it was primarily to say, my wife isn't doing a good enough job or she needs a bit of support. So it wasn't even about themselves. So we have pushed the envelope in terms of trying to raise the profile with men. And I think men themselves have become more aware of their role in the family home, and they're more aware of their role in supporting their children and being more engaged with their children's issues. So last year, for the first time in 2023, 1 in 4 of our calls came from a male parent, which is absolutely outstanding. You know, that's the highest number of males that have ever rang Parentline.
Is it a service that can expand or should expand, or do you see it developing more into the future?
Well, we've right now where we're at, you know, is kind of capacity for us at the moment in that we've 60 volunteers, which is more volunteers than has ever been there in the 42-year history. The call numbers have doubled since 2019. You know, up to about 2019, we were getting roughly 3,000 calls a year. Since that rose to over 4,000 in 2020, and then 21, 22 and 23, that has been around the 6,000 calls. Last year was our record year, 6,147 calls. So the most important thing for us is that there's no point in having a service as good as Parentline if people aren't aware of it. So, you know, what I'm out there trying to do is to increase the profile of Parentline so that parents know that the service is there and that the service is there to support them. And not just in listing, any parent can look on the Parentline website. We have a number of specific programs on a one-to-one basis that help parents to deal with childhood anxiety, with child-to-parent violence, a number of other areas. But as I say, it's a fantastic service, volunteer-driven, and, you know, really, it would be great if every parent who needs the service was aware that the service was there.
Well, look, maybe in the last little while we've played some part in increasing awareness and knowledge about it. Aileen Hickey, Chief Executive of Parentline, thank you so much indeed for coming to join us on the podcast. Thank you for your insights.
My pleasure.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.